to another episode of Living Downstream. This episode is going to deviate a little bit from the norm. We'll be sharing the recording of a recent panel discussion that we held on the impact of climate change on wildlife in the Pacific Northwest. If you missed the event last Friday, February 11th, now's your chance to catch it. If you're interested, we also have the video recording available. We'll be putting that on our website, so by the time you hear this, it'll probably be available for you to watch. If you're interested in any of the resources mentioned in this episode, please feel free to reach out to Ryan at umpquawatersheds.org. Again, that's Ryan at umpquawatersheds.org, and I will be happy to send those links to you. Greetings, everyone. My name is Ryan Kincaid, and I use she, her pronouns. I'm the Director of Education and Outreach for Umpqua Watersheds. I will be moderating the session this evening. Welcome to tonight's event, The Impact of Climate Change on Wildlife in the Pacific Northwest. And actually, we're going to start with a land acknowledgement, and then I'll go through the rest of the plan for this evening. We acknowledge that the land where the Umpqua watershed is located was historically occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Poquel, Malala, and others. Their story is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity toward the natural environment, which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. After the next few words I'm going to say, we're also going to have some introductions from our hosts and event panelists. Then we'll have the panel discussion, which will last about an hour, with then half an hour or so for a Q&A. Just send those questions to me, and we'll bring those questions up during that Q&A. At the end of tonight's session, we'll invite you to some other future events that Umpqua Watersheds and the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition will be offering. We're so glad to have you here tonight. So I'd like to introduce our event hosts and panelists. With us tonight, we have Casey Hovick, the Executive Director of Umpqua Watersheds, Stuart Leibowitz, a founding board member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, Angela Jensen, Conservation and Legal Director for Umpqua Watersheds, Stan Petrowski, President/Director of South Umpqua Rural Community Partnership, Jeffrey Dose, retired Umpqua National Forest Fisheries Biologist, and Robert Bailey, President of the Alaka Alliance. A lot of great experts who are sharing their time, background, knowledge, and expertise with you tonight. All right, Casey, would you like to share a little about Umpqua Watersheds?
Absolutely. And I just want to thank everyone for being here tonight. This is our first climate event. So grateful to be co-hosting this with our friends at the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. They've done great work for years, and we look forward to continue to partner with them as well as our friends at SOCAN to do other events moving forward. The climate crisis is something that impacts everything we do and will do for generations to come. So we really want to put focus and educate the community and engage the community regarding the options that we have available to us. So let me tell you a little about Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is dedicated to the protection and restoration of the ecosystems of the Umpqua watershed and beyond through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. Umpqua Watersheds envisions a land of lush mountains and river valleys that sustain an abundance of clean water, diverse wildlife, and native fish runs. These landscapes will enrich a community that values fulfilling jobs, diverse viewpoints, and a solitude of wild places. Umpqua Watersheds is run, the engine of Umpqua Watersheds are our committees. We have a very small support staff. Our office manager, Melanie McKinnon, does wonderful work for us at 35 hours a week, and would be lost without her. We have a part-time people, as was mentioned in our introductions, but our committees are really the engine that makes Umpqua Watersheds work. Conservation Committee does important work in ground truthing and in writing comments to our agencies, engaging our membership and the public regarding various conservation issues. A very important part of our conservation committee is our wilderness committee, and they are a very active committee, and they meet once a month and are really engaged in the Crater Lake Wilderness Campaign, as well as taking people out on hikes and seeing the wonderful Umpqua that we all celebrate. Outreach committee is very important. I'm the chair of that committee. We have several events in addition to doing hikes. We do our annual membership banquet and silent auction, which will be in April. We do these types of events, the climate events that we'll be having. We'll be doing diversity, equity, and inclusion events. We are getting back into the Umpqua Brewfest that we've done for 10 years. This year, we're going to have two of them. One will be the Umpqua Brewfest Redux in June, and then our regular second Saturday of October will be our 11th official Umpqua Brewfest. So outreach is something that's really important to the organization. Restoration is very important too. Right now, we have a UCC intern that is involved, Spencer Dietrich. He is our Archie Creek Fire Restoration Coordinator, and we've had two events so far with the public to get people out on the Archie Creek Fire area and doing restoration. We're also working with Phoenix School, the Forest Service, the BLM on doing various restoration projects in Archie Creek. Finally, we have an education committee that is so important, and Ryan Kincaid leads up that committee as our director of education and outreach. Climate change is part of that committee, as well as our diversity, equity, and inclusion committees. Umpqua Watershed's goals is to advocate sound stewardship practices on private and public lands that sustain biodiversity and restore degraded lands and waterways. We promote and permit protection for wilderness and roadless areas in southwestern Oregon. We alert our community to ecosystem management issues in the interest of informed consent and increased participation in land management decisions. We train youth and adults to develop expertise in natural resources sciences for careers in ecological stewardship workforce. And we educate the public by expanding environmental literacy and increasing awareness of the intrinsic value of high-functioning, intact ecosystems. We improve communication and collaboration between the conservation community, public agencies, private landowners, commercial interests, and the public at large. We monitor the activities of the federal, state, and local agencies charged with the responsibility of land and water management in southwestern Oregon. We also provide leadership, support, and motivation to local and regional grassroots conservationists. We have several organizations that we partner with, including the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. We have several others, the Pacific Northwest Forest Alliance, the Pacific Northwest Climate Forest Climate Alliance. We also conduct educational research and outreach projects that highlight conservation challenges and promote effective solutions. We serve as a source of information on conservation issues and solutions. And finally, we celebrate the natural beauty and majesty of the native forests in free-flowing waters of the Umpqua and beyond through regular outreach events. Please join us at our meetings. All our committee meetings are online. Right now, they're all via Zoom, and we post them at umpquawatersheds.org and also on Facebook. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Casey. Stuart, would you like to share a little about the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition and where things are with climate change currently?
Yes, I'll talk a little bit about our coalition and also the current status of climate change that we're facing right now. So on behalf of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, we are pleased to co-sponsor with Umpqua Watersheds this important forum on the impact of climate change on wildlife in the Pacific Northwest. Our mission statement is, a catalyst for promoting a healthy climate for our community and future generations, identifying and sharing solutions through awareness, advocacy, and collaboration. Coalition is an all-volunteer grassroots organization that has worked on climate change for 19 years. This panel discussion is just the latest in a long line of presentations we have brought to Douglas County that have been part of the most recent scientific information on climate change. And during these 19 years, we have seen climate change become a climate crisis to the climate emergency we have today. What has brought us to this point is a dramatic increase in fossil fuel emitting carbon dioxide, 280 parts per million before the Industrial Revolution, to over 420 parts per million today. Result, a global temperature increase of nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And we see the consequences for wildlife all around us. Ocean acidification threatening shellfish, unprecedented wildfires endangering biodiversity, warming rivers and streams impacting our fish habitat. What is particularly insidious that climate change acts as a multiplier effect, magnifying already existing threats to our environment. Although the last 5 years have been the hottest 5 years on record, the worst is yet to come. Scientists tell us we must reduce our climate pollution 45% over the next 10 years if we are to keep the climate from spinning out of control. So, how are we doing? 2021, emissions worldwide actually rose 6%. Dirty coal use reached an all-time high and it increased 17% in the United States alone. Even if all the countries of the world kept its emission reduction pledges made at the recent climate summit in Glasgow, global temperatures would rise to nearly 5 degrees Fahrenheit by century's end. The fact that our own country is unable to keep its pledge to reduce emissions by 50% due to the inability to pass the Build Back Better Act jeopardizes even this unacceptable temperature increase. Thus, we will face even more dire consequences for the wildlife that we hold dear. No wonder that one United Nations projection estimates that up to 1 million plant and animal species will be in danger of extinction during the 21st century. Today, our expert panelists will discuss what climate change means for our wildlife now and in the future, and most important, what we can do to protect nature's gift to the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you, Stuart. Next, Angela will give an overview of the focus of today's panel.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Angela Jensen. I'm the Conservation and Legal Director for Umpqua Watersheds. I am very excited for tonight's panel discussion, and I sincerely hope that we can help disseminate some information to those joining us tonight to encourage action, because we are indeed in a climate emergency. And this emergency does not just affect us, but the wildlife and ecosystems around us, along with the services that they provide and the services that we all too often take for granted. I just want to state generally that the Earth's climate is constantly changing on a natural level, but this fact often causes a great deal of confusion and is used to support denial that we even have a problem, but in fact we do. So I would like to dispel with that right away. As mentioned already, the part per million of greenhouse gas concentration in our atmosphere is well above the historic fluctuation of 200 to 300 parts per million. We are now somewhere around 420, in fact. And science has already provided that this increased concentration of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere directly contributes to our planet's inability to cool. This is because greenhouse gas molecules absorb radiation that would otherwise be reflected back to space. Instead of the radiation being reflected away from the Earth's surface, it is in fact reflected back to the surface, causing additional warming of our planet's surface. This is called the greenhouse effect. And it is this effect that is causing the anthropogenic or human-caused climate shift that we are experiencing now. It is especially important to understand that this is human caused. We are increasing the part per million emissions of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere predominantly by the use of carbon dioxide, okay? And this is largely caused by the burning of fossil fuels for electricity generation, transportation, and industry. But we are also emitting carbon dioxide and its equivalents. And that's important to understand, is that greenhouse gases come in many forms, like methane. Okay, and these are being emitted through other sources, like our agricultural processes. Here in our region, in the Pacific Northwest, logging is in fact the number one, the largest emitter of carbon dioxide, which is especially important to realize because not only does industrial logging emit CO2, it also removes our forest's ability to sequester carbon, which would in fact mitigate this climate crisis. Additionally, it removes habitat for our wildlife, which makes it harder for them to adapt to our changing climate. So we have been warned extensively about what outcomes we will experience from extreme weather events, sea level rise, increased warming in freshwater habitats, decreased snowpack, ocean acidification, the list goes on. This is what we're set to experience. We're already experiencing it. But what does this mean for wildlife? And specifically, what does it mean for wildlife and ecosystems here at home in the Pacific Northwest? And that is what we're here to discuss this evening.
Thank you, Angela. Now each panelist will share a little bit about their background and area of expertise. Jeff, would you like to go first?
Certainly. Thank you, Ryan. My name is Jeff Dose. I'm a native Oregonian. I grew up in Coos Bay in Eugene. Graduated from Sheldon High School and went to Oregon State University. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I was a professional fisheries biologist for 35 years. 31 of those years were in Southwest Oregon, studying salmon and steelhead primarily, and the aquatic ecosystems that they inhabit and require. I've worked in conservation, I've worked in restoration, making attempt, and I'm also been very active in my professional society, the American Fishery Society. I actually authored a chapter in a book that was published by the American Fisheries Society called Salmon 2100, which is the future of Pacific salmon in the Pacific Northwest. If you get a chance, take a look at it. My chapter is by far and away the best. I'm kidding. It's really an interesting read. I was the fisheries program manager on the Umpqua National Forest for 24 years before my retirement at the end of 2011. Since then, I've been active in various conservation activities, including being president of the Steamboaters, science advisor to the North Umpqua Foundation, member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition, and also a member of the North Umpqua Coalition, which is a group that is primarily interested in putting together various resources to protect the North Umpqua and its fisheries. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Bob, you can go next.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Yeah, my name is Bob Bailey, Robert Bailey, or as when my mother would call me, Robert John Bailey. Grew up in North Bend and had the good fortune to get into what we now call coastal management back in the early 70s. I spent 35 years with the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development, helping coastal communities to not only comply with the statewide planning goals for estuaries, beaches and dunes, shorelands, and so on. But I had the good fortune of leading up the state's ocean management program that coordinates among the various state and federal agencies and stakeholders. So I have a long experience in all things coastal and ocean. And like Jeff, I grew up in North Bend on southwestern Oregon, had relatives up and down the Coos and Curry County. So my roots go back a ways. I got into this Alaska Alliance position about 5 years ago based on a long-term friendship with a man named Dave Hatch, a member of the Siletz Tribal Council, Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, who back in the late 1990s and early 2000s was advocating the idea that the absence of sea otters from the Oregon coast, that they had been hunted out more than a century before, had unknown and likely profound effects on the diversity, resilience, and productivity of our nearshore marine environment. At the time, Dave was not in a position to really push this idea forward, but he did have a group of informal contacts he called the Alaka Alliance. Years later, when I retired in 2011, a couple of years after that, reached out to Dave to find out what had happened to his effort, only to find out that he had recently passed away. So between myself, Dave's son, Peter, Robert Kenta from the Siletz tribe, Don Ivy from the Coquels, Bobby Hall at Oregon State, and a number of others, we decided to pick up Dave's flag that the time was right to try to bring sea otters, this important animal, back to Oregon's nearshore environment, and in the process, make it more robust, resilient, and diverse. Many of the things that were talked about previously about the importance of watersheds and watershed councils and why diversity and resilience in our forest and watershed environments is important, is equally important in the ocean. And we're seeing, as we will discuss, an alarming change in the nearshore and estuarine environments, not just from the absence of sea otters, but from a changing ocean world. And it's the ocean that's the engine that drives so much of the atmospheric changes that affect all of us, affect all of our watersheds. And so our goal, our mission, is to bring sea otters back to the Oregon coast. But we are going to be doing that in the context of a marine environment that's changing before our very eyes. We think we can still be successful, but there are a number of factors that give us pause, such as warming ocean conditions that inhibit the growth of kelp, the increased acidification that can affect the availability of shellfish, which are the prey of sea otters, of really a very interesting side effect, which is a northward expansion of great white sharks due to warming waters. And those sharks predate inadvertently, but they do predate on sea otters. So there's a number of ways in which a changing climate affects the nearshore environment and will affect our ability to bring this important keystone species back to Oregon's coastal environment.
Thanks, Bob. And last but not least, Stan.
All right, we're unmuted. I was just scrolling through the list of names. There's many of you that I know and love. It is good to see you here. And those of you who I don't know, welcome. Glad to make your acquaintance. My list of engagements related to restoration ecology, for the most part, kind of started getting formalized in the year 2000. At that time, I was a co-founder, and presently I'm the president and director of the South Umpqua Rural Community Partnership. We focus mainly on aquatic and terrestrial habitat restoration. I was also on the board of directors of Umpqua Watersheds for the better part of 12 years, chaired that organization for 5 years. Presently, I'm also producing a weekly radio show called the Radioactive Restoration Show, where we focus on issues related to restoration ecology on a world level and try to stay abreast of the radical changes that we're seeing in ecosystems. I'm also the river steward for the South Umpqua River for the Native Fish Society. I served on the board of directors of the Lamakatsi Restoration Project for quite a few years. I served on the board of directors and chaired for part of the time the Partnership for Umpqua Rivers. And attendant with all of these organizations has been a plethora of committee chairs and with a collaborative relationship with other organizations. All of these things pretty much ran tangentially together. I wound up being involved in the issues related to the natural world and its conditions post-Vietnam. I'm also a Vietnam vet, along with Jeff. When I came home from the war. I headed for the hills, very passionate about the living world, the web of life, the food web. And I've, over the course of the last 50 years, have watched radical changes taking place associated with climatic changes. And I'm deeply concerned about it. Really feel honored to be on the panel and associated with you all.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA, brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds.
All right, so at this point, we're going to transition to the panel discussion itself. I will ask various questions for particular panelists or to the group as a whole to answer. So to get things started, I have a few questions about the state of things right now in the Pacific Northwest. All right, so this first question is for Bob. How has climate change affected Oregon's coastal/marine environment?
Thanks very much. I would just say that we're starting to see impacts. Certainly, the early wake-up call was ocean acidification, and that is an increased in the CO2 being dissolved into the ocean that caused the water to be slightly more acidic and affect. The first indicator was affecting the very young oysters being hatched in a hatchery over on Neatarts Bay. And since then, scientists have measured the effect of this increased acidity of ocean waters on a wide range of, particularly the youngest stages of marine life, zooplankton that contain or depend on calcium for building their shell structure, internal shell structure or external. So certainly ocean acidification is one. Hypoxia is another one, although it's the direct links with climate change are a little obscure, but basically it's there's warming ocean waters and the upwelling that brings more nutrients to the surface off the Oregon coast, which in most years is a great thing to feed the food web, is an overabundance of nutrients causing these plankton blooms that then die. Fall to the bottom and soak up oxygen as they decay, depriving the other critters, crab, fish, and other marine life. And that's that warming water and overabundance of plankton due to the changing marine temperatures. So one of the other things is just the warming temperatures. Warming temperatures are not good for kelp. And kelp forests are the engine, the ecological engine, just as forests in our watersheds are the biological engine in the watersheds. Kelp forests are also the biological engine in the near shore, and they're being affected by a warming ocean and by a spread of sea urchins. Sea urchins are the natural prey of sea otters, which were hunted out 100 years ago. Sea urchins are also the prey of a large starfish called Pycnopodia. Those Pycnopodia were by and large wiped out all the way from Alaska to Baja California about 6 or 7 years ago due to a mysterious disease, fungus, something. Almost overnight along this entire region, those animals were affected and died off, suddenly releasing sea urchins to mow down kelp forests. So between this expanse of urchin barrens and the warming ocean waters that inhibit the growth of kelp, we've got a problem on our hands. So we're starting to see that. I'm not sure that anybody can attribute, large storm events to and increased wave heights to climate change. Like most of you, I've lived here most of my life, and big storms are no stranger to the Oregon coast. But as someone said earlier in the evening, it's these large storm events on top of increased sea levels that will have the long-term effect into our estuaries and on our ocean shoreline. So yes, we're already starting to see these effects in the marine and nearshore environment.
Thanks, Bob. Do you want to go over anything on this slide or the other one that's about marine heat waves?
Yeah, let's go back to the graph. Thank you. Just as, you know, like we had that big heat dome this year. Yeah, we get temperatures in the 80s, 90s, and 100s in the summer. But when you get those extra 5, 10, 15 degree days in succession, and those patterns repeat, you know, annually and become more and more severe, those anomalies above the average temperatures really affect things. And the same is true in the ocean. So you can see the anomalies here, or the marine heat waves, the record of those since 1900. And I'm not going to go into all the details of what the data show, but the trend is that there are more and more intense marine heat waves over the last 100 plus years. The public first kind of got tipped off to this, to the blob, as it were, in 2014. And that blob has stuck around in one form or another for a number of years. And these, again, is a map of the anomalies of heat in the marine environment of the northeastern Pacific Ocean. So you can see the darker reds are where the anomaly is up to 2.5 to 3 degrees above normal, above average, and the blues are where it's below average. So you can see that there has been a persistent increase in the marine temperatures of the Northeast Pacific Ocean, and that drives everything, the weather patterns, the temperatures, the jet stream that flow down out of Alaska, the Gulf of Alaska, across Canada, and across our region. So it's this giant engine of heat that's stored out there in the ocean that's affecting everything. So I'll stop there.
All right. Thanks, Bob. All right. So next we'll go to Stan, and I have a couple of questions for you. Can you talk a little about summer low flow, and also how has climate change affected wetlands in the Pacific Northwest?
All right. So yes, there's been a series of papers, peer-reviewed papers published related to the transition that's taking place ecologically in our aquatic systems. Perry Jones started this whole process by reviewing data, a 60-year database from the Coyote Creek watershed here in the Tiller Ranger District Experimental Forest and the Pacific Northwest Experimental Forest further up north. And basically there's two things that have transpired. One, the resource extraction industry, mainly logging, but it includes mining and agriculture, has radically affected stream flows. Now, I've done interviews with what we would call elders in our area here. Singularly, every single one of them have said that the perennial streams are now either intermittent or not flowing at all in various headwater watersheds. This is really significant. Basically, the summer low flow dynamic is related to logging management practices. What they've discovered is that the first 10 to 15 years of tree plantation growth allows for winter peak flows. But after that period, you have a dearth of, there's a heavy impact on aquifers, and it causes a summer low flow signature. So these perennial streams are no longer running perennially, primarily because of forest management practices. But there's another factor. In the Coyote Creek Experimental Forest, there was a definite signature of climate change, a trend of less water and warmer water in our systems. When you have less water flowing in the stream, they're more likely to take up a higher percentage of heat, which in turn has a drastic effect on juvenile anadromous fish and other aquatic species. There are more and more papers being published related to low flow, and the major factor is the timber industry and their management practices.
Yeah, it's easy to see, particularly in the wintertime, when you look at the clear-cut patches across the mountainous landscape, and you can see this, you know, after a snowfall, you can see the snow in the clear-cut areas. You can't really see the snow that's in the deep forest. So guess which snow is going to melt first? It's that's exposed to the sun. It's going to melt and flow right downstream rather than the snow that's in the deep forest that's going to take weeks or months to melt and eventually find its way to the streams. So the more of that land is cleared for logging and exposed to the sunshine, the snowpack really does no good.
Yes, and on top of that, I'd like to mention that a lot of the Cascadia watersheds, not so much, you know, in the headwaters, but lower down, the winter flow rates are very drastic, and you have a transient snow-fed system, so you have more flow in the winter for a shorter period of time, and hotter and drier for a longer period of time. This is what the climate change signature looks like in terms of hydrological processes.
We'll be right back after a few brief announcements. Are you a teacher or homeschooling parent in Southern Oregon? Umpqua Watersheds has an event that may be of interest to you. We are organizing a free training for local educators, which will take place April 13th to 15th, and through grants we receive from the Cliff Family Foundation and Roundhouse Foundation, we are able to provide books and other resources, as well as a $100 stipend to each participant. We only have 15 spots available, and they will fill up quickly, so sign up today. Email Ryan at umpquawatersheds.org for the form to register.
This next question is for Jeff. What have been the impacts so far on our aquatic ecosystems, including lakes, rivers, and streams?
Thank you, Ryan. Addressing how climate change is impacting our aquatic resources, I'm going to be speaking primarily about our anadromous fish, salmon and steelhead, for several reasons. First of all, they are, or at least were, omnipresent in the rivers and streams of the Pacific Northwest. They've been around for 3 to 6 million years, so they're a pretty adaptive species. They are, in a sense, a canary in the coal mine, if you will, and they have declined precipitously. University of Washington estimated that circa 1800, there were 50 to 130 million salmon in the Pacific Northwest in the rivers and streams, and that today their estimate is that there's only 3% left of what was there in 1800. Since then, much of the decline has actually occurred prior to the point where climate change was widely recognized. Doesn't mean that it didn't happen, but it does mean that it wasn't recognized at the time. And some of the issues, well, first of all, look at that top slide there. It seems sort of redundant, but fish in general require fit water. And salmon in particular are cold water fishes, and they require cold water. The second one, salmon populations, like the lower right picture there, is a spring Chinook. And there are a couple of populations that require adults to spend all summer in the rivers and streams prior to their spawning in the fall. And they are particularly susceptible to warmer water temperatures. And the consequence is usually that either a higher than normal pre-spawning mortality, and or motion up into the uppermost portions of the watershed, which leads to overcrowding and phenomena known as superimposition, and that's where one fish will spawn on top of another's reds. The lower left slide there, in addition to adults, their offspring, such as these juvenile steelhead, are present in these rivers and streams for up to 3 years. The combination of reduced flows and warm water temperatures, as Stan mentioned, can greatly reduce survival of these juveniles prior to their migration to the ocean, which greatly reduces their abundance in time. That's a major factor in the reduction down to 3% of historical abundance. So what are some of the causes? Well, it's been mentioned already, but timber harvest is a major factor in aquatic and hydraulic functioning. These activities compact soils, they reduce infiltration. Roads are not only compact our watersheds, they often intercept groundwater from road cuts and cold water that otherwise would contribute to salmon streams downslope. A consequence of current timber harvest is the establishment of high-density monoculture plantations. Long-term research, Stan mentioned this, revealed that stream flows in treated watershed, that is harvested watersheds, have reduced stream flows by up to 50%, and that reduction has continued for at least 50 years. And the mechanism is transpiration of groundwater from the young trees in the plantation. So these are timber, it's been mentioned, but the timber management activities and most of our aquatic resource in Pacific Northwest are forested ecosystems. And they've been dramatically impacted by human activities. Another one, upper right there, out of water or out of channel uses of water, such as irrigation for agriculture, for domestic and municipal and industrial uses, have greatly reduced stream flows. And stream flows are very much affected by, or water temperatures are very much affected by stream flows. And so if you reduce the stream flows, you're gonna almost inevitably increase water temperature. As I said before, our native fishes are cold water fishes. And so anything that increases water temperature is gonna have an adverse impact on their abundance and survival. The middle slide there, another impactor is hydropower dams. Dams not only impede, but often preclude upstream passage of adults and can dramatically impact survival downstream migrants of juveniles heading to the ocean. There are also heat sinks that often end up warming the rivers downstream. They also have provided habitat for predators that focus on juvenile salmon and steelhead on their downstream migration. The next one down the bottom there is also from the University of Washington Research School of Fisheries. And it basically shows the impact of how climate change is affecting snowpack and therefore stream flows and water temperatures. And it shows in 1960 that the streams that they were measuring in the state of Washington were at 62 degrees Fahrenheit as the 3-day maximum or 5-day maximum temperature, which is very good for native cold water fishes. By 2020, those temperatures had increased to 67 degrees. And we're on the edge there. The preferred water temperature for our native cold water salmon and steelhead is 65. So we're on the edge there. And by 2080, they predicted that the temperatures would be up into the 70s. And that's going to be have dramatic impacts on the distribution and abundance of our native salmon and steelhead. And the little bottom parts of that graph are basically showing lots of fish, medium number of fish, and hardly any fish. So it's real. I guess in summary, we need to understand that human activities, even before climate change was widely recognized as an impactor, had already affected our salmon and steelhead and our native aquatic ecosystems. And that I believe that climate change is just going to exacerbate, make it worse, and or prevent any sort of meaningful restoration of our stream flows and water temperatures. And it's going to have dramatic impacts on the overall production of our salmon and steelhead.
Thanks, Jeff. This next question is for any or all of the panelists. What challenges do severe weather events, such as the recent heat dome that we experienced, pose to wildlife? So I guess any of our panelists want to try to tackle that one?
Yeah, Ryan, this is Stan.
Sure.
So I immediately was aware of significant change during the Omega heat dome event. Apart from my observations, I live in the middle of Umpqua National Forest, and I noticed a significant impact on the insect populations. Now, I also have a small apiary. I've got honeybees. And prior to the heat dome, my observations of the hive were that for that time of year, there was an abundant supply of nutrients in terms of honey and nectar and pollen. After the heat dome event, all of my hives had a radical drop in reserves in honey and in pollen. And by the end of the summer season, I was actually having to supplement the feeding of my bees with pollen substitutes and sugar syrup, which I don't do. I'm a hardcore granola, and I like nature to do its thing, but I would have lost, if not all, most of my hives. I immediately saw the same thing with regard to the bumblebees, the butterflies. The flowers were smitten. The nectar sources were smitten. It was an unbelievable and drastic change.
May I speak to that too?
Go ahead, Cindy.
Sure. Well, just to point something out, since I also observed both forest response to the heat dome, as well as farm response to the heat dome, because I have a little farm and that keeps me connected to a lot of things. And just for people's information, that heat dome, apparently in regards to farm animals, 651,000 animals died from that. And that was mainly chickens and other poultry. But keep that in mind, because what we're talking about there, and that happened to me as well. I had some chickens, no matter how hard I tried to keep them cool, that died. And the key issue here is that organisms like chickens, like birds in general, and bats and other species that have really high base temperature in the first place, or high body mass. Another thing, bears had some really hard time with it. Anything like that is going to have a huge impact with the heat that we're now experiencing. And the other thing I saw in the forest after the heat dome, when I was monitoring a wetland, was that in the forest itself, especially along the roads do so much impact. There was a lot of scalding and of the needles of the fir trees. such that there were still needles that were green, but there was lots of needles that were brown, meaning they were going to lose a lot of their photosynthesis capacity. And I saw insect, attacks, and it was actually not so much that in the interior forest, but along the edges of the forest, the trees were literally pushing out pitch to address that. And I assume that was insect attack that was going on, but they were pushing out pitch regardless. And the other thing I saw in the wetlands was, we've got wetlands that are going through a complete change, perhaps a threshold here, where they're becoming eutrophic. And our wetlands are not eutrophic wetlands. And they're becoming eutrophic. And as a result of that, they're actually probably emitting methane, because normally wetlands will store carbon, and when they're functioning, these wetlands would, when they're functioning properly. And it would appear, though it's not been measured, that they're probably now emitting methane. So that's definitely happening in your reservoirs, and it's probably happening in our native wetlands, which we have so few of. And obviously, they're going to be less water associated with the wetlands as well.
You're listening to an episode of Living Downstream on KQUA. Brought to you by Umpqua Watersheds.
All right, now that we've heard a little bit about what's currently happening and the changes already being seen, let's dive into some of the predicted outcomes and trends. So this first question in this section I'm going to pose to Angela. Climate change does not just affect species, as we're seeing. I mean, this is a panel mainly about the impacts on wildlife, but it's also the impacts on habitats and ecosystems. So what are the expected effects of climate change on various habitats and ecosystems, and which ones are likely to be the most significantly impacted?
That is a big question. And I'm honestly I don't know that I can answer it as accurately as I want to, but I do. Here's what I'm going to say. Think of the food chain and the food web that you learned in elementary science classes. The simple food web illustrates how one species survives off the consumption of another, creating a chain through several species. When this chain is interrupted, species above the interruption are in fact impacted. The food web illustrates this same reality, just with multiple species. So when we speak of effects on an ecosystem level, this is what we're talking about. So let's picture this web with multiple variables, like changes in average temperature. We've already talked about this. Changes in average temperature, reduced river flow and stream flows, increased freshwater temperatures, increased wildfire events, etc. This is everything that we're already seeing in the Pacific Northwest, and we will continue to see. But this is how we illustrate climate change impacts on an ecosystem level. It's a bunch of bands that are being disrupted. Everything is fluctuating. Climate change is and will affect ecosystems and the services they provide. So it's kind of like a stone thrown into quiet water. The ripple effect is going to be very evident. And very little, if anything, is going to be left untouched or unaffected. So here's just a basic picture of what this looks like in the Pacific Northwest. We are already experiencing, as already mentioned, decreased snowpack, increased surface and water temperatures, wildfire events, and in fact, intense wildfire events. All these things are changing and will continue to change species compositions at the bottom of the food chain. This change in dynamics alters the balance of predators and herbivorous species. Okay, so for example, when the herbaceous material is altered due to changes in temperature, precipitation, wildfires, the food source and habitat for subsequent consumers is also going to change. And these species are also going to have to change in order to survive. So in a nutshell, climate change changes the interactions between species and interrupting what we could otherwise deem as a status quo. We've already been talking about this. So it changes status quo or what we would otherwise perceive as a predictable balance. In other words, climate change produces an imbalance to what we currently understand as normal. So this is where we need to talk about adaptation. So for survival purposes, it's predicted that species will be forced to migrate. And it's been predicted that species are going to migrate poleward and into higher elevations because they're going to want to travel to more cooler temperatures. And that goes for species across the board. So migration is simply an individual species response to change, right? So this is a form of adaptation. And when one species, particularly at the bottom of the food chain or in the center of the food web, so to speak, makes a change for purposes of survival, this act of adaptation forces other species to change norms and habitats for survival or habits for survival purposes as well. Like you can't shake one thing without other things having to adapt and change. So it's nearly impossible to predict with any great certainty what climate change will do to our habitats and ecosystems here in the Pacific Northwest in the long term. I mean, we're already seeing these changes that we've talked about, but in the long term, it's hard to predict. We know that things will change. They will continue to change and be disrupted. But the level of disruption in the long term is going to be determined by the level of increased warming that we're going to experience. So will we keep the warming to below 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels? It's doubtful. I don't think we can. I think we're already there. Will we keep it below 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels as what was mandated in the Paris Agreement? I don't know. But these small degrees differences are going to have impacts, right? So these sound like small changes, a half a degree, but these subtle differences in temperature rise, they will have a profound impact on the smallest of species simply because of disruptions in hydrology and surface warming, as we've already discussed, causing that ripple effect that we've been talking about. I think it's important to recognize that one of the biggest reasons it's difficult to predict with any great certainty what climate change will do at the ecosystem level is also because species and habitat disruptions will and are affecting both what we call detrimental as well as beneficial species. Okay, so for example, invasive and non-native species could negatively be impacted, which hypothetically would make room for native species to expand and survive if the native species could properly adapt to the coming changes. The only thing we can be certain of is that with species dynamics, habitats and ecosystems will continue to shift with the changing climate. They will obviously seek a means to adapt for purposes of survival. And when it comes to our native species, we need to do what we can to facilitate that adaptation.
Join us again tomorrow at 6 p.m. Pacific time to hear part 2 of the recording of this panel.